Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me to go through the big old binder of baseball cards. And we've got an interesting set that we're looking back on today. A set that was actually the end of an era in the hobby. And the beginning of a new era, the beginning of several new eras, actually. We're looking at 1973 Topps, the last of the vintage era of baseball cards, the true vintage era, you know, not cards from the 70s and early 80s, just because that's 35 years ago, but a lot of changes in the hobby and what Topps was doing moving on after 1973. But a set that, even though it went through a lot of changes, and the hobby was about to go through a lot of changes, and the sport was about to go through a lot of changes, Topps still put out a pretty decent product. A lot of people don't like it, but a lot of people do. 73 Topps definitely falling in the boat of you either like it or you don't. I like it. I'll share why a little later on in the program. And we'll also look at our random pull, card number 372. And what a random pull it is. Oscar Charles Gamble. Yes, the one and only Oscar Gamble, a guy who never won a World Series, never was an all-star, despite having some pretty productive years, even in New York City with the Yankees, and having a decent, lengthy career in baseball. A high draft pick for the Chicago Cubs, a guy who had a grand total of 17 years in this game, played over 1,500 games. But that's not the part of Oscar Gamble you know about. You know Oscar Gamble because of his massive afro, an afro that actually did measure 8 inches. That's pretty impressive. And while the 73 Topps card is also impressive for a number of good and bad reasons, it's not quite up there as the 76 Topps traded card, the legendary card where he had the airbrushed Yankees cap pushing down several inches of that 8-inch afro. Now, one good thing about this card, if you look at it on our Twitter feed or if you're listening to us and you've got the Audio Boom page ready to look at, one of the good things about this particular card, even though it's one of the wonky action cards that Topps made that year, you definitely know of the three players that are pictured in this action shot. You know which one is Oscar Gamble. It is not the white guy with the short hair. And I'll put it there. Oscar Gamble does have a very interesting story with or without hair. And we will discuss that later on as well. First, let's discuss what you're discussing at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, as we had a lot of commentary on our most recent new podcast on 72 Topps featuring Clyde Wright, a pitcher who has very fortunately cleaned up his social life in the last 30-plus years, has gotten nice and clean and sober, and is still in the history books with the Angels franchise. I don't want to say the California Angels, but the Angels franchise, which has had as many uniform changes as name changes ever since their inception in 1961. But I loved the picture on Clyde Wright's card where he did kind of this faux action shot, and you've got a portion of the Big A scoreboard from the original design of Anaheim Stadium in the background. And we had one of our listeners, Uncle Dave, sending a copy of another 72 Topps Angels card, Billy Cowan. He says, one of my favorite cards in the set. And you can check out the Wax and Gum Stains timeline for this. Billy Cowan also in front of the Big A scoreboard, but the camera is positioned perfectly to where it's kind of looking up at Cowan as he's in a batting stance, and the halo from the scoreboard delicately placed right above his head. It is a beauty of a card, certainly not your common card, but thank you very much for sharing that, Uncle Dave. We had a full range of thoughts on the 72 Topps set, and it is a set that I like, even though it is flawed, and as I said in the podcast, it is delightfully tacky. It is a set that screams 1972, and because it screams 1972, people tend to overlook some of the flaws that are in that set. And the Shaw Law Office is chiming in with the flaws. Didn't like this year of Tops. Too much border, hard to read backs. Brightside still showed minor league and career stats, but the border. And yeah, there was a lot of space dedicated to the white border. I think it was Tops going at the other end of the spectrum after the magnificent black border cards from 1971. But, you know, that's the loudest part of the card. The front of the card is not only the white border, but the team name leaping out at you in this 3D, you know, sock it to me kind of font at the top of the card there. And I absolutely agree with you on the back of the card. And that's what I said in the podcast is one of the most frustrating and biggest flaws of the set. Because of the gray card stock, because of the choice of colors where Tops went with this orange and black motif on the back, it's very hard to read. And especially with players who had lengthy careers, you needed a magnifying glass to read some of the stats on there. So that was one of the biggest flaws of the 72 set. But again, a lot of people, myself included, you kind of overlook it because it is so 1972. You don't want to get too wrapped up in some of the little imperfections there. 1970s baseball actually replying to the Shaw Law Office response. I agree. And why on earth did they decide to go with positions on the front of the cards that year? I wish I could tell you exactly why, but as I mentioned in the podcast, I actually like it because the simplicity of just having the name of the player at the bottom of the card definitely balanced out the Shazam presentation at the top of the card. So I'm okay with it. I know some fans aren't, though, and Topps would certainly make good with that in 1973, where in lieu of a team logo, you had plenty of space devoted to the player's position, including the new designated hitter position for certain players in the American League that year. Now, not everybody despises 72 Tops. Banner Season says, always loved the packaging of the 72s. Player listening for the sound of the ocean in a baseball. I never really noticed that. I actually, you know, looked back at the wrappers that we tweeted out the day before. And, you know, I always thought it was this kind of neat little cartoonish drawing on there. And I likened it to the board game Payday, which actually came out, I believe, in 1975. But it was that same funkadelic yellow submarine style of drawing that you saw in the board game Payday, the original version. I know several revised versions have come out and it's been modernized since. But the artwork on the wax packs reminded me of that. And I never really thought that he was listening to the sound of the ocean in a baseball. So a very nice capture there. A quick correction on our random poll. Clyde Wright from CompleteYourSets.com. You said he was from Johnson City, Tennessee. He's actually from Jefferson City, Tennessee, right down the road from me. He went to the same college as my wife. Well, my apologies. I'm very, very particular about getting the facts correct with podcasts like this. That's a journalism 101 thing that I really harp on, and I get upset at myself when I goof up like that. So my apologies. Johnson City, Tennessee is not where Clyde Wright was from. He was from Jefferson City, Tennessee. So I got my former presidents wrong, not Andrew Johnson, but Thomas Jefferson. So Johnson, Jefferson, Jefferson, Johnson. I own it up to a brain fart, but I try not to have too many of those. So my apologies for the friends and family of the residents of Jefferson City. That is where Clyde Wright is from, not Johnson City. Now, I got an interesting tweet from Ryan Stonebreaker. He actually reached out to us a while back when we were doing, I forget which podcast it was, but I want to say it was in the 1985-86 era. So it was one of our earlier shows. And we mentioned, you know, your favorite sets. Tell us your must-have sets or your top 10 sets from the junk wax era. And I know Ryan was somebody who was a big fan of 86 Tops, and he said that he would actually make cards for the high school baseball team on the 86 Tops design. And this year, he put them out in the 87 Tops design, which I know a lot of people, most collectors, still like. The Wilton Beavers, RVC Baseball Champs. He sends us a picture of Caleb Timpson, one of the members of the team with the 87 Tops design. So nice job there, Ryan. Good work as always. And thank you for sharing that. Sam Olson also sharing us a nice little wax find as he bought four 1980s packs. So we have 86, 87, 88, and 89. I mean, we're right at the beginning, the seeds starting to germinate in the junk wax era here, but still some great cards. Four 1980s packs, four team leaders cards, zero manager cards, and four players with double appearances. And how odd is this? Just four packs of cards. So you're looking at, well, let's see, 87 had 17 cards in the pack. I think the others would have had 15. So out of 62 total cards, you end up with eight cards featuring the four same players. So we have two Jesse Barfield cards, 88 and 89, two Jim Pankovic cards, and that's 86 and 88, two Candy Maldonado cards, 87 and 88, and two Gary Reedus cards from 86 and 88. So what are the odds that of all the sequencing, especially again from the, you know, the early days of the gluttony of the junk wax era, you end up with the same four players in different years of these packs here. And I pointed out that of the cards, too, each player has a very suspicious I'm in trouble look in his card. In particular, the Barfield and Pankovic and Reedus 88 tops cards, and then the Maldonado 87 tops card. So a good find there. I'm sorry you got the team leaders cards. Those are not really exciting, especially, you know, from a set like 86 or 88 tops. But I'm glad you didn't get the dreaded manager card. Craig Mergenthal, responding to that post from Sam, asked the question, did anyone actually win those trips to spring training? Seems like it was a long-running promotion. And he's referring to what you saw in the Topps wax packs, and it was a big promotion. In fact, I think they did it throughout the mid to late 80s into the early 90s. I think you saw that, I want to say 85 through maybe even 91. Where, you know, at the bottom of the wax pack, it would say, you know, win a trip to spring training, spring fever baseball. So I don't know if anybody necessarily won those. You know, we've got a sizable audience for the show, but I don't think it's that sizable. But I'm curious if anybody actually entered to win these contests, because you had those entry cards in every stinking pack. So if you entered those contests, or if you actually won one of those contests to go to spring training back in the late 80s or early 90s, please let us know at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm just as curious as Craig. Now, speaking of buying into things, we had another auction break. In fact, yesterday we posted it. Two packs of 1983 Fleer baseball. Wax pack 916 was our winning bidder. And thank you for participating in that. We had a few people jockeying back and forth throughout the weekend to get that. Unfortunately, no big cards in those two packs. No Sandberg, no Gwynn, no Boggs, no Ripken second year, no Henderson fourth year card. But he did get one of the combo cards, and this is one of the neat things that Fleer did, not only in 83, but they did it in 84 and 85, and they may have done it in 86 as well, where they would have two cards back-to-back in the sequence, and this was in the higher end of the series, where they would take a picture of two players. You may have two teammates, or what was typically done was they would get two all-stars together at the all-star game, pair them up with each other, and then basically take that photo and stretch it out over two cards and basically cut the photo in half. So there was one instance in the 83 Fleer set where you had this combo card of Speed and Power. And Speed was Ricky Henderson. Power was Reggie Jackson. Now, Jackson was with the Angels at that time. Henderson, his first stint with the Oakland A's. And lo and behold, Wax Pack 916 in the same pack got those two cards. So we were able to put those together. That was a neat little thing there. Also, a Fernando Valenzuela card where if it was 1983, that would mean something. Nowadays, okay, maybe you can get a dollar for it. But no big star cards, unfortunately, outside of that Jackson and Henderson Speed and Power combo. But Some great cards. 83 Fleer is one of my favorite designs from Fleer. It was their first year of finally getting it right. And the first year, in my opinion, where they had this great stretch of cards. 83 through 87, I think, was their best. I think they had some decent cards in 88, 89. Pretty good set in 1990. I always loved 90 Fleer. But even though you got some common cards, you got some neat cards to look at, including some young star cards for a guy like Willie McGee, Steve Bedrosian as well. But, you know, that's also the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat of doing a break on vintage cards. You know, you look back a couple of weeks ago, we had the 84 Topps Rack Pack where Andrew, our listener in San Diego, not only got the Tony Gwynn second year card, which was featured, you could see that in the pack, but also landed the Don Mattingly rookie, and there were a couple other cards like a Frank Viola, and that would have been Frankie V's, I think, second or third year card. A couple of good young players from the early 80s, nothing that's going to break the bank, but to get the Gwynn second year and the Mattingly rookie, that's a nice return on the investment on the auction. So I'm glad, Wax Pack 916, you enjoyed the break. And you're looking forward to adding those cards to your collection. So we will be sending them out to you. In case you didn't watch the video, we still have a link on Wax and Gum Stains, or, you know, go to YouTube. You can type in Wax Ecstatic 83 Fleer Break and it'll show up there. Our next item up for bids will be a 1985 Topps Cello Pack, which features a Dale Murphy card on the top and on the bottom a Lance Parrish All-Star card. Now, that is not Clemens and McGuire, to say the least, but at least you know you got a couple of decent cards on the top and the bottom, and we will see what is within the 26 cards in between, hopefully not stained too much by the very archaic piece of bubblegum still floating around in the middle there. So we will put that up for bids this upcoming weekend. And we encourage you to take part in that. You know, we set the bids low, you know, especially for stuff that's from the 80s. You know, we did have a pack of 77 Topps where we nudged it up a little bit. But if you're, you know, looking to just toss out a $5, $6, $7 bid on something like that, you know, that gets things going. And then we just see who wants it most in the end. And hopefully we get a good card or two out of those pulls. I did order some more unopened packs from some reputable dealers. We'll be hitting a lot of stuff from the early 80s, but keep an eye out for that. And, you know, if I can find a gem from the 70s, I will get that out there. But I have noticed, and maybe it's just me, I'll ask you, have you noticed the market for unopened wax from like the 70s, even going into 80 and 81, it has really skyrocketed over the last few months, really, because that's something I've always kept an eye on. But, you know, I've been looking, you know, you could get packs in the past. And, you know, again, when I say past, I mean just a few months ago of 78 and 79 Topps, you know, if you win it at an auction, maybe $10 or $15. But, you know, now I'm seeing these things being bid up to $30, $40, $50. So I don't know what's causing it. Maybe it's just because we're in the middle of the baseball season. I don't know. But it's a little mystifying. So I'm going to try to get some stuff from the 70s, but I can't guarantee it because right now the market is just a little high. Now, if somebody wants to offer up, you know, hey, Matt, I'll give you $50, find some stuff from, you know, the late 70s, then yeah, I can go fishing around. We can buy that pack. We can do a break. We can do things like that. But I do want to try to find something that everybody can bid on and work together to see, you know, what's inside these packs. One other quick question about the auction bids, and I put this question on Twitter, haven't gotten any responses yet. So I'll try this way. If I don't get any responses, then I know nobody cares. But regarding auctions, curious what your thoughts are about vending boxes. The vending boxes, typically from the 80s, although you have some from the 90s and some from the 70s and 60s, but you talk about a limited market. There's not many out there, and those will set you back a few hundred, if not thousands of dollars to get a truly unopened box of cards from like 1972. But you know, looking at a vending box for, say, 84 Topps or 86 Topps or, you know, something like that, just curious if anybody would be interested in participating in auctions for that. And the only way I would break that is I would open the box and we would very quickly thumb through them to find the star cards. But you would still get the entire collection within the vending box. Now, the price point for those would be a little higher simply because you're dealing with higher shipping charges, you know, with the wax packs or the cello packs. I don't charge shipping and handling on those auctions because honestly, it's $2, $3. It's not that much. It's included in the final auction price. But for the vending boxes, you're looking at probably about $15 to start it just to cover the shipping and handling. And of course, you're getting 500 cards as opposed to, you know, 15, 20, 25 cards in a rack pack or a cello pack, whatever the case is. So just your thoughts, if you wanted to do a vending card, would you, or a vending box, I should say, would you do it? And if so, what years would you like? You know, I don't want to put up a vending box of 88 tops if nobody cares. And I would completely understand if you didn't. But if there's enough interest, if several people say, hey, you know, yeah, maybe something from the early 80s tops or other brands, we'd do it. Then, you know, I'll go scouting around for something and we'll put it up there and just have you all fight over it. So we'll see, you know, how people respond to that. We'll see how you respond to the 85 tops cello as well. And thanks again to all those who have participated so far. It's been fun, and it's been fun enough and worthy enough of everybody's time, trouble, and dollars to keep it going. So we'll try to do it every week, and we'll just you know, see what's out there and, you know, ultimately see what's in there in the packs with future breaks. All right, let's break into our look at 73 tops. Again, a set that I say is a good set. But not everybody is like that, and that's okay. You know, as I've said before, this podcast is not the gospel of baseball cards. It is my opinion. I offer your opinions, and we just put them all out there. And we encourage people to discuss the opinions, you know, at Wax and Gum Stains. And as you saw, you know, just going through that list of comments that I went through, you know, we have people talking about our podcast, talking about our players and the sets or just stuff that they bought. So, you know, it's an open discussion. And, you know, I certainly can see why you would think one thing about 73 tops over the other. I personally like it because there's a lot going on with these cards. And they also dialed down the zany factor from the 72 tops set. With that said, there are some flaws. We'll talk about them. But I know some people, they don't like 73 tops because it's a little dull. They would rather tops had gone the other way and ramped up the excitement, while 73 tops keeps it safe, but not too safe. So let's take a look at our random poll, card number 372, Oscar Gamble. And this is an interesting card because it is one of the action shots that Topps went with in 1973. Now, we mentioned before that Topps first showed action shots in 1971. They dialed it back a little bit in 1972 in base cards, but they featured a whole lot of insert cards called In Action. Well, in 1973, they took out the In Action subset. That actually helped reduce the size of the set from that monstrous size in 1972 to just 660 cards in 1973. But the problem is that, again, because of technical limitations, a lot of the action shots are far away. There's too much action going on in the shot. And that has set up some hilariously awful baseball cards from the 73 top set. Now, the Oscar Gamble shot here, like I joked around before, even though there are three players featured in this picture, because it is clearly taken from the third base dugout, and again, technology not being what it is today, what it was back then, it's a faraway shot of Gamble sliding into second base here against the Cincinnati Reds. You can easily pick out Oscar Gamble because the very beginning of his massive afro is sticking out there. His helmet has clearly slid off here. And you know which one is Oscar Gamble. And you know what's funny? I said there are three players here. I just took a closer look at the card. There's actually four. there's a player, a second baseman for Cincinnati. It's not Joe Morgan. But a second baseman for Cincinnati is actually on the ground at Veterans Stadium. And Gamble had kicked up a whole bunch of dust with his slide. And Davey Concepcion is standing at shortstop. And you see there's an outfielder roaming around in the background. So you see three players and the head of a fourth player just kind of floating around on this card. So this is this is actually not one of the worst cards that you see, but you can see where some collectors don't like it, because if you want to collect a card of Oscar Gamble, you want a picture of Oscar Gamble, not half of the Cincinnati Reds roster. Also, the player card here has a neat little goof up in it, in that Topps made no attempt to airbrush anything Cleveland Indians related onto Gamble's jersey. You can clearly see that Gamble was playing for the Phillies when this shot was taken likely during the 1972 season. So never mind the fact that the Indians wouldn't play the Reds in the pre-interleague days of baseball back in the early 1970s. But here we go, not even attempting to put an Indian head on there or just try to color up the jersey like it was an Indian's jersey. They did blot out the Phillies P on it, but you can still see the piping that went down the shoulders and the sleeves, and you can also see Gamble's uniform number on the lower right side of his uniform, which is what the Phillies had back in the early 70s. Now, with that said, not everybody was subject to such treatment. In fact, Greg Nettles' card, Topps went a little too far trying to stencil in a New York Yankees logo. He had been traded from, it might have been the Indians or the Twins. I forget which team he was coming from. But they tried to stencil on a Yankees logo, and they stenciled it a little too much. He's, coming through on a swing, and if you Google the 73 Topps Greg Nettles card, you'll see that the Yankee logo takes up almost the entire front of the jersey. So a little trial and error with players on the move in 1973. Topps would remedy that in 74 with their traded series of cards within the main series, but they didn't really try too hard in some cases, or they went a little overboard with the airbrushing in the 73 set. Now back to the action shots. While the Gamble shot is not that bad, you've got some pretty good action photos, to be honest with you. The Bill Frien card is one of my favorites, and I have that in my collection. A pretty exciting play. It looks like it's against the Yankees as Frien is reaching back trying to tag a runner who's sliding into home plate. And you see in the background about 20 or 30 people who are sitting down low and they're standing up. You know, the anticipation, the anxiety of is the player going to be out or safe at home here? So that's a pretty neat action shot. There are other action shots in there as well that really show you the entire game and, you know, bring you this element of the game that clearly was not in the 20 plus years of cards that Topps or any other manufacturer had been able to show before. But you also get a lot of laughable photographs from the 73 set. Now, perhaps later this week, I'll be able to pull together a few photographs of some of my favorite bad cards from the 73 top set, but I'll throw out a few names at you if you want to, take a look at some of the pictures that aren't exactly flattering. Tommy Agee is a great one. Tommy Agee is pictured, catching a pop-up in shallow center field. But again, you know, much like the Oscar Gamble card, there's a couple of other players roaming around in the picture. Plus, you see the backside of an umpire who's getting ready to make the call there. So it's not that good. Also, Willie Stargell, an action shot here of him, collecting a ball at first base. But the shot is taken so far away, again, from the third base dugout, where, you have a member of the Phillies, running towards first base. But you almost have to squint to see Stargell in action. Same thing with George Scott, who was then a first baseman for the Milwaukee Brewers. He's fielding a ball during a pickoff play. It looks like there's a member of the Oakland A's sliding back into first, but the shot is from third base. It's from so far back. George Scott, who is a very big man, looks very, very, very tiny in this picture. Eli Rodriguez, another one of my favorites, is Rodriguez picking up a ball and looks like he's going to make a throw over to first base. The problem is that, again, this was taken from back in the stands here. Rodriguez not only, in the midst of making a throw, but there's a Brewers pitcher just off to the left here. And Ellie's card features more of an umpire's ass than Eli Rodriguez. Joe Rudy, that is an infamous picture as Joe Rudy is seen crossing the plate with a couple of his Oakland A's teammates. The problem is, none of them are Joe Rudy. So you've got three random Oakland A's featured on the card with Joe Rudy's name on it as well. Some other interesting cards from that set that are actually decent. You know, Frank Robinson, then with the Angels, although he's pictured with the Dodgers on a follow-through on a swing. It looks like a home run swing, too. You had some pretty interesting views of that card. Chris Spire sliding into a home plate with the San Francisco Giants. That's an interesting one. But again, for every good one, there was a couple of bad ones. Steve Garvey is actually getting blocked out by a teammate. Garvey had clearly hit a home run in this picture here, but Wes Parker is blocking him out in this photograph. So you see an awful lot of Wes Parker's backside and not enough of Steve Garvey coming across the plate. And another favorite of mine, Dave Nelson, who is a third baseman for the Texas Rangers. Well, it's a faraway shot again from the stands behind home plate as Nelson was sliding into second base. This is after he slid into second. You have more Oakland A's in this picture, including the backside of a pitcher, than you actually do of Dave Nelson. But my all-time favorite, and I will share this at Wax and Gum Stains later this week, my all-time favorite bad 73 Topps card is Luis Alvarado. Luis Alvarado was a utility infielder for the Chicago White Sox. And back in the 70s, the White Sox practiced or did spring training at Payne Park in Sarasota. Now, this is before the days of multi-million dollar spring training and practice facilities throughout America. In fact, a lot of spring training facilities, even in the mid-70s, were basically glorified city or county parks. They were basically just a collection of ball fields that were strung together by a few sets of grandstands, and that was it. And that was definitely the situation in Sarasota back then. The White Sox and Payne Park, that was basically just a glorified county parks department situation there. So Alvarado, who is identified as the shortstop for the White Sox, he's fielding the ball at second base from the White Sox second baseman. But the funny thing is again, you know, this is probably shot from the first base dugout, and then they super zoomed in on the original shot here. So you have this play being made, but you have the backside of the White Sox second baseman, but really, the best part of this is the parking lot full of early 70s, late 60s, early 70s junker cars in the background. So this doesn't look like the Chicago White Sox spring training. This looks like a beer league softball team playing at your local city park here. So 73 Tops had a little too much action. You know, fans were clamoring for more action shots, but in a lot of cases, it didn't work out. Now, the Oscar Gamble card, it does, even though it's not the best shot, it works okay. But again, for every really good shot, like the Bill Freehan play at home, you've got two or three, you know, Dave Nelsons or Luis Alvarados. You know, there's just these ridiculous shots. Now, Topps would pay the price for it. A lot of people really don't like the photography in this set. So while they tried to advance it, it kind of backfired a little bit. Now, Topps would include action shots in a lot of their future sets, but 73, they just went overboard. So you'll see in 74 and 75, they dial back a little bit on it. And that's a bit of a shame because as technology would improve, Topps would get some better action shots, especially by the late 80s. You got some pretty good pictures in some of these cards here. But by dialing back on some of the action shots, that basically left the posed shots for a lot of the base cards, and the quality of those shots is just not that good. In fact, the posed shots or the stage shots in 73 and especially in 74, 75, just not good quality. The colors washed out a little bit. The players don't look really that interested in taking their pictures. So you kind of go through this lull in photography or photographic creativity in the mid-70s. And that's something Topps would actually struggle with throughout the 70s. Like I said, you didn't really get the quality action shots until you got into the 80s. Now, this Oscar Gamble card, it's a little different than the regular base card because it's an action shot. You're seeing the front of the card presented horizontally. For most of the other cards, it's a vertical presentation, but the design is pretty much the same. Now, if you don't like white border, you don't like 73 tops, there's a lot of white border on the front of these cards, but there is a neat little design element here that you would see throughout other products in the 1970s. You have this thick black inside border. You have the photograph inside the black border. But again, instead of a team logo or a second photograph of a player on the front of the card, you had a little caricature, kind of a shadowed caricature of the player's prime position. So for Oscar Gamble, he was an outfielder, and you have this picture of an outfielder leaping, making a catch on top of this green dot. And you would see throughout the set different caricatures for different positions. So you have, catcher on top of a yellow dot. You had a first baseman on top of a pink dot, third baseman on top of a pink dot. You had a pitcher as well. So you had these, again, these shadowy pictures in the background and, these color dots in front of it. And that's kind of a neat thing there. It was a little different from, a team logo or another picture of a player. But for those of you that missed out on the positions in the 72 set, well, you definitely got your money's worth in 73, as that was a prime part of the presentation on the front of the card. Now, again, a lot of people won't like the overall design of this set because of all the white space, but I'm old enough to remember, and chances are you are too, this is something, a design that you saw in a lot of other things, and I remember they weren't really flash cards. They were kind of designed like flash cards, but there were a lot of educational materials that were designed like this where, maybe it was like a Ranger Rick flash card series of different types of trees or different types of weather, cloud formation, stuff like that, where you had this exact same design where you had, a big picture, but also, some kind of icon, almost like the shadowy outfielder on the Oscar Gamble card in the corner. So, different types of weather patterns or clouds or birds or trees or you name it had its own logo. I almost call this the National Parks design. And National Parks for decades have had this very similar design. It doesn't matter if you're in a park in Wyoming or in Maine or Florida. You've got, the signs all look the same. The logos look the same. The maps look the same. Back in the 70s and 80s, what you see in the 73 Topps card, you saw in a lot of national parks then. So I call it the National Park design, the Ranger Rick design. This is a design element that you saw through a lot of, especially educational materials, but certainly some promotional materials as well. So again, you may not be a big fan of the design. I'm okay with it, but you can see why some people don't like it, because there's a whole lot of space devoted to white border and position logo as opposed to the actual photograph. And I can see why that could drive some people crazy, while others, such as myself, they're totally okay with it. So while the front of the cards are up for debate, the backs of the cards, I think 73 Topps has a winner. First of all, as you can see in this particular card, it doesn't matter if the front was horizontal or vertical in presentation, the back was vertical. First time Topps had done that since 1968. They would do it again in 1975, and then that was it. You wouldn't have a vertical presentation of cards until the 1993 set. And I think something that makes this work, like I said, it's the first time since 1968 they went vertical. They went with a very similar color combination here, although it doesn't stand out. It's not as striking as the 68 set, because in 68 they had the white card stock, while in 73 they had the gray card stock. You still have the color combination of black and yellow. A little bit of a Pittsburgh Pirates or Pittsburgh Steelers look to it. It looks really sharp. It's very easy to read. And it's a nice contrast to the almost all-white front that you see on the card. Now, with the black borders on the backs, that did cause some trouble with the condition of these cards, keeping these in mint condition. And you can even see the wear and tear that you see on the back. It isn't reflected on the front of the card. So I'm sure that drives some collectors crazy as well. But I think overall the design of these cards is pretty good. And also the little cartoons at the top, I've got several 73 Topps cards, actually more than several. I've got probably about 100 of them. I've flipped through them, and the cartoons are pretty funny. Not always the best information, you know, in the case of Oscar Gamble. Oscar enjoys watching football. And, well, okay, that's all we got on him. So it's not really in-depth stuff here. But I like a lot of the cartoons. So if you have some 73 Topps cards, just flip through the backs of them and see what you can pull from the backs of these cards. Now, as I mentioned, 73 Topps, a 660-card set. The big rookie card, the Mike Schmidt rookie. And that's another one of those multi-panel cards. So if you're looking for Mike Schmidt's, you know, solo card, his first solo card, if you will, you have to wait till the 74 set. But he is featured not even on a Phillies rookie card. It is the rookie third baseman card. So Schmidt sans mustache featured on the far right panel. The Penguin, Ron Say, on the far left panel. And then the lesser known third baseman for the San Diego Padres at the time, John Hilton, smack dab in the middle. So that is the big card from that set. You do have a pretty good collection of Hall of Famers and, you know, interesting team sets too. You know, the team checklist didn't just feature a photograph of the team, but it was this collection of faux autographs that I think is actually pretty interesting. Also, you've got, you know, some legendary player cards like Nolan Ryan. Of course, you've got Reggie Jackson, all the big stars that would, you know, come up throughout the early to mid 70s. You've got featured in this set. So even though the set is smaller, it's 127 cards fewer than what you saw in 1972. You still have a pretty good collection of players here led by that rookie card of Mike Schmidt. Also some other notable rookies in this set, Bob Boone, Dwight Evans, and also Goose Gossage. Now, as I mentioned earlier, 73 was the end of an era in the hobby because this would be the last year that Topps would issue a set in multiple series. In 1974, they would release the entire set all at once. That was a practice that they did all the way up through 1992. Again, the 93 set was the first time that they would split the set into series. Now, they weren't the first set to do that. Upper Deck actually did that in 89 and 90 with the High Series cards, which featured, you know, some more rookies or some notable players who had been traded either prior to that year or early on in the year. Donruss and Score would jump on the bandwagon in 1991, and certainly by 92, most everybody else was doing that. Topps did so in 93. And if you listen to any of my older podcasts on the 90 and 91 sets I was just talking about, it wasn't just to stagger the release of cards in one or two or in sometimes three series, but it was also mostly to market new inserts. And Upper Deck was legendary at this. You know, people would buy the low series cards 1 through 700 just because of the quality of the Upper Deck brand. But the upper, or the high number series, I should say, cards 701 through 800, not only to get a hot rookie or not only to get the, you know, the latest picture of a player who changed teams or a team that changed uniforms, but also for inserts. You know, they would put in, you know, the Hank Aaron career set, you know, with the exclusive Hank Aaron signed cards or the Ted Williams signed cards or the Reggie Jackson signed cards. So it was a great marketing ploy, and baseball card companies still do it to this day, where, you know, you've got different, typically higher end inserts and contest in the second series or latter series, because the first series you're going to buy just to have your hands on the brand new set and the baseball season starting and you're pretty excited. But then, you know, by May and June, when the season starts getting into its dog days a little bit, this is when the second series comes out with, you know, the game worn memorabilia or autograph cards or you name it. You typically see that in a second series. So it spikes interest. It helps move cards and helps keep people tuned into the hobby and the game throughout the entire part of, or throughout the entire duration, I should say, of the season. So there's a lot of collectors who will take 73 Topps, and that's the point of demarcation of the end of the vintage era. Now, there are some people who will also move the goalposts. They say, okay, it's not 73 anymore. They'll move it up to 1980. because in 1981, that was the first time Topps had some consistent competition from Fleer and Donruss, and then later on Score, Upper Deck, you name it. So there are some people that consider 1980 and before then as vintage. And then there are some people that have a completely different set of rules there, whether it's 73 or 80, they have another barrier, typically around 1999 or maybe, you know, 97. You know, they basically mark off the junk wax era. So 81 through, again, you know, some point in time, the mid to late 90s. And a lot of people, you know, after 1999, that's the modern era. So this was a change in collecting. This was a change in the hobby. And it also reflects a change in the sport. You know, if you ask any baseball historian, you know, the game was starting to get turned upside down around 1973 for a number of reasons. One, the dawn of the designated hitter in the American League. That was certainly a big thing there. And I still pray to God that the National League never adopts the DH rule. I prefer the tactician. You know, you actually have to manage in the National League with matchups. And, you know, when the pitcher comes up to bat, you know, are you pinch hitting? You know, there's a lot more at stake in a National League game as opposed to an American League game, in my opinion. Even though I love American League baseball, hey, I love the Tampa Bay Rays. I grew up a Toronto Blue Jays fan. So, you know, I was certainly exposed to a lot of American League baseball in my life. But, you know, the dawn of the designated hitter, not only changing the rules for one league, but also extending careers for some players who, in many ways, you know, their career should have been done in 72, 73, 74, but the DH allowed them to keep playing for several more years after. Oscar Gamble, actually, a great example of that. He was often caught in log jams of outfields, you know, not only in New York, but also Chicago and Cleveland and Philadelphia. So, you know, he got bounced around, but he was still able to bring his bat to the game as a designated hitter. So you have that, but you also have, you know, the Curt Flood case was going through at this time. You had baseball's first strikes in 1972. You would have subsequent ones throughout the 70s. You had the dawn of free agency following the 1976 season. And the game really changed. Some will say for the better, some will say for the worse. But you had a lot of tumult in baseball going on right at this time. So it's only appropriate that the hobby changed with the sport as well. Now, Topps would get burned for its single series release in 1974 with the almost vacating of San Diego by the Padres for Washington, D.C. We'll talk more about that in next week's new podcast. But it was an interesting time for the hobby, for the sport, and a big change that, again, many collectors mark as the end of the vintage baseball card era when Topps stopped releasing the set in series and went out there and just put out one big, you know, in the case of 1974, 660 card set. Now, overall, again, 73 Topps, I like it. I know a lot of collectors don't because of the generous amount of white border on the fronts of the cards. Also, 73 Topps, if you collect a lot of these, notoriously miscut. There's a lot of off-center cards. So a lot of people don't like it because you can't really get a perfectly centered card, a lot of miscut cards in these sets here. So, you know, I understand a lot of people don't like it. And it wasn't just 73 that was miscut. You know, that was something that Topps fought with throughout the 70s. But I know in particular, 72, 73, 74, 75, for whatever reason, those cards were, you know, either off center or even diamond cut. And that drives a lot of collectors crazy. But on the surface, just the general design, the general layout, the fact that this is the last vintage set of cards that Topps put out, I like it overall. And I think one reason why I like it too is this, I don't think it was the first vintage set, but this was one of the first vintage sets that I was able to get my hands on when I was a teenager. You could buy the common cards. And again, this is, you know, the late 80s when I started doing this, you could buy the common cards relatively cheap because, you know, back then they were only 15, 16 years old. So you could get a common card for a quarter in mint condition. You know, now you're looking at a set that's 44 years old. So a common card in mint condition may actually cost you a dollar, depending which series it's from. But I think overall it's a pretty good set, and I do believe that that tie that I have to the set being one of the first vintage sets that I could afford to, you know, spend a few extra pennies on to pull out some of those cards. I've had this long connection with 73 Tops, so I like it. Some people don't, and that's perfectly fine with me. Now, Oscar Gamble, our random pull. Again, this is a guy who didn't win a World Series, was never an all-star player, only once was in the MVP race. And when I say the MVP race, I mean a distant runner in the MVP race, finishing 29th in the American League MVP race with the Chicago White Sox, a team that wasn't very good. But this is back when Bill Veeck owned the White Sox the second time around. And the Southside Hitmen, as they were known, Veeck had a problem with keeping funds with pretty much every ball team he ever owned. So he would bring in these veterans who had only 1 year left on their contract. He would put out a team that was competitive but not quite good enough to win, and then he wouldn't re-sign the players, or he would trade their rights so that he didn't have to re-sign them. And that was, and he even said this in his autobiography, Veeck is in Wreck, in a postscript, because that was originally put out in 1962, but they did a revised, updated version in the early 1980s. That was the only way that he could survive, because the White Sox were not making a lot of money in the decrepit old Comiskey Park. They couldn't compete with the Yankees and the Dodgers and other teams that just had money at their feet. So they would bring in somebody who could, you know, pop 25 or 30 home runs and then just let him walk the next year. And that's actually what Oscar Gamble did. A native of Alabama, Raymer, Alabama, actually grew up in the Montgomery, Alabama area. And he was quite the star back then. In fact, he was scouted by the legendary Buck O'Neill, the Negro League star. Was a scout for the Chicago Cubs in the 1960s, and he said, you guys need to pick up this kid. He's going to be something. So the Cubs draft him in the 16th round of the 68 amateur draft, and they fast-tracked him. In fact, he was drafted in June of 1968 and would make his major league debut in the 1969 season. In fact, he appeared in 24 games the latter half of the season for the Cubs as they were trying to hang on to a playoff spot in the National League East race against the New York Mets. Of course, they didn't work out too well in that endeavor. And unfortunately for Gamble, neither did he. 24 games, a .225 batting average, just one home run. So the Cubs, under Leo DeRocher, very quickly decided to just move on from him. So in the offseason in 1969, they trade him along with Dick Selma to the Philadelphia Phillies for Johnny Callison and Larry Colton. Now, Colton was the ubiquitous player to be named later in this deal, so kind of a wash up front. Well, in his brief time in Philadelphia, he would start getting more playing time, but not enough to become a regular. As I mentioned before, he would constantly get caught up in these number games in the outfield. And with Philadelphia, and of course, this is pre-DH, he couldn't really work himself into the lineup. He never played more than 100 games in his three full seasons in Philadelphia. So again, he's biding his time and he's getting upset that he's not playing enough. Well, this is why he starts growing the afro. Kid you not, this wasn't like a, you know, a black power statement that he was making, although a lot of artists and, you know, people that were, you know, still trying to move the, you know, move the needle on race rights and civil rights in the early 70s, they would grow these huge afros as a sign of black independence. Well, that was less the issue with Oscar Gamble here. He grew out the afro so that he would be noticed. You know, you couldn't miss the guy with the 8-inch afro and you know, cramming his ball cap, you know, on top of this afro. So that's how he tried to get noticed. Well, unfortunately, it didn't really work, even with the Phillies. After the 72 season, he and Roger Fried shipped off to Cleveland for Del Unser and minor leaguer Terry Wedgwood. Well, this is where the designated hitter helps out Oscar Gamble. Even though he would play a lot of games in the outfield in Cleveland, you know, the Indians were not a very good team, so there were plenty of open roster spots. Well, he got more time out on the field, and he starts producing. You know, he's appearing in 120 or so games a year, hitting around 280 on average, and he's starting to show some of the power that Buck O'Neill saw when he was scouting him several years before. 1973 has 20 home runs for the Tribe, hits 267, has 19 and 15 home runs in 74 and 75. And now he's starting to make a name for himself. Of course, his afro is starting to catch the attention of a lot of people, and the Indians were notoriously bad and cheap. So they traded him to the New York Yankees in November of 1975 for pitcher Pat Dobson, and that was the end of the Oscar Gamble afro. George Steinbrenner wanted none of that. Of course, Steinbrenner had a very tight rule about not just properly maintained hair on top of your head, but no facial hair, as he had numerous run-ins with Don Mattingly in his time with the Yankees. Well, right after the trade to the Yankees, Oscar Gamble is sent to training, and the limo that picked him up at the airport didn't take him to the Yankees training complex. It took him to a barber. Yeah, that's right. Before you could put on the pinstripes, you had to have your hair cut. So about 7 inches of the afro gets lopped off, and very quickly, Oscar Gamble becomes a uniform member of the New York Yankees. And that's why the 76 Topps traded card, which features the infamous big afro sprouting out from both sides of the Yankee cap. Well, you knew it was airbrushed to begin with, but it's a little bit of a misnomer. Oscar Gamble was never able to wear a Yankee hat while having that big afro of his. Well, in 1976, he appears in 110 games for the Yankees, has 17 home runs, a .232 batting average, but again, can't work his way into the lineup. They have a logjam of players in the outfield. Did participate in their postseason, was part of the ALCS win over Kansas City, also appeared in a handful of games against Cincinnati, but the Reds swept the Yankees that year. And the Yankees acquired some guy named Reggie Jackson, so all of a sudden, Oscar Gamble is expendable, and that's how he would end up in Chicago, as he was traded along with minor leaguer Robert Polinski and an up-and-coming young pitcher named Lamar Hoyt, and cash, what did I tell you about money, and the White Sox, for some guy named Bucky Dent. That's right, the guy who would break the hearts of Boston Red Sox fans just a couple years later. Oscar Gamble was one of the guys who went the other way. I mentioned his best season, a 31 home run season with the White Sox. He was granted free agency, signed a pretty lucrative contract with the San Diego Padres, lucrative in 1978 standards, $475,000. You can't even get a bat boy for $475,000 now. But Gamble was not able to adjust to the National League batters. He was not able to adjust to the cavernous Jack Murphy Stadium in San Diego. And he was moved out pretty quickly. Played just 1 year with the Padres, a .275 batting average, 7 home runs. Moves on from San Diego as they trade him to the Texas Rangers. An interesting trade here. Dave Roberts goes with him to Texas for Mike Hargrove, Bill Fahey, and the rather oddball Kurt Bevecqua. Well, he would be in Texas for just a short time, traded later to the New York Yankees, joins Mickey Rivers there, and he would start his second stint with the Yankees, which lasted a lot longer than the first one, as he was able to play with the Yankees through 1984. Again, finds his way on the south side of Chicago as a free agent in 1985, but by then, the wheels had fallen off, batted .203, only 4 home runs, and his career would end after the 1985 season. Now, again, his career numbers, nothing spectacular, but a serviceable 17-year career, .265 batting average, 200 home runs on the nose, 1,195 hits, and just under 1,600 games, career mark of 1,584. So a guy who was able to take advantage of the designated hitter rule a little bit, especially in his later years, but who always found himself in a log jam, and to try to separate himself from the rest of the logs in the outfield, he would grow that massive afro and get noticed. And he is still noticed to this day. Oscar Gamble's afro, far more memorable than much of his career. And again, that's not taking anything away from his career because he had a pretty decent career. But a lot of people remember him for the fro as opposed to anything he did on or off the field. He ran a discotheque in Cleveland while he was there. He was a pretty snappy dresser as well. A lot of newspaper writers didn't like him, though. Because, you know, they called him lethargic, didn't think he was hustling out there. And that is often a backhanded slap, a racist comment. You know, a lot of African-American athletes far superior to the white athletes, especially in the 50s and 60s. So a lot of people, instead of giving these athletes their due and saying, hey, this guy's better than that guy, you know, Jackie Robinson's better than this guy, Willie McCovey's better than that guy, they would often, mock African-American or even just dark-skinned players, especially Caribbean-born players like Roberto Clemente. And they would go, oh, well, he's just kind of loafing out in the outfield. Hank Aaron got that all the time, too. You know, Hank Aaron did not run as fast as a Jackie Robinson or even a Willie Mays. So they're like, oh, he's just kind of loafing around out in the outfield. Well, that was a backhanded comment because, you know, Hank Aaron only hit 755 home runs. He was pretty good at baseball. so he was pretty good at the sport, but a lot of people, because of their racist or biased ways, just couldn't see that. So Oscar Gamble fell, you know, under that umbrella, unfortunately. You know, he had to fight to get into the lineup. And then when he did, and especially his most productive years, which would be 73 through 77, you could qualify as his best years. He had some pretty productive years, too, in the early 80s when he went back to the Yankees. You know, even though this guy was still hitting anywhere from 15 to 20 home runs on average and was still averaging around, you know, 265, 270 batting average, you know, they would just try to knock him down a peg. Oh, yeah, he's lazy. You know, he gets into the lineup and then he does nothing with it. So, you know, that was part of the overt racism that Oscar Gamble and other players had to deal with at the time. Fortunately, though, Oscar Gamble was able to deal with it, is still very productive, and I have to say, is bald. So the days of the Gamble afro are long gone, but he still looks back at his career, you know, rather nicely. You know, he occasionally, according to several reports I've read, coaches youth baseball, is a mentor towards a lot of players, and still signs a lot of those 76 Topps cards and other pictures from particularly from the early to mid 70s. Before that day in 1975 when George Steinbrenner traded for him and said, get a haircut and get a real job. Oscar Gamble, our random pull from the 73 set, card number 372. So your thoughts about Oscar Gamble, the overambitious action shots of 73 Tops, or just anything on your mind, go ahead and comment away at Wax and Gum Stains on our Twitter feed. Also, please remind your friends, collectors now or collectors in the past, tell them about Wax and Gum Stains. Tell them that we've got new episodes via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Stitcher every Tuesday. We have Flashback Friday episodes as well, so you can check out some of our older podcasts throughout the weekends. And it's great to have everybody here, you know, talking about these old cards and looking back at the early days of the Oscar Gamble afro in this rather busy action card from the 1973 Topps set. Well, 1974 sees Topps dial it back a little bit, cut back on some of the ambitious action shots, and also cut back on all the series. They made one big series, one big set. And they got burned for it, thanks to the San Diego Padres and Ray Kroc coming in at the last minute to keep the team from relocating to Washington, D.C. We'll talk about 74 Tops in our next new episode. That's next Tuesday. So be on the lookout for that. And also keep an eye out for our next auction bid or auction item up for bid, I should say, the 85 Tops Cello Pack. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.